It's Thursday, March 4th, and there's no E for effort during a pandemic. We start here. As supply ramps up, the Biden administration tries to make sure teachers can get vaccinated immediately.
The CDC says that's not a prerequisite to having teachers back in the classroom.
No, but they would feel more comfortable and they would be more willing to do it.
But is this about science or politics? We're tracking this year's schoolyard fight. Today's like any other day, unless you believe the government's about to get overthrown.
The conspiracy theory goes that actually Donald Trump would now return to Washington on March 4th.
Why law enforcement is concerned about another assault on the Capitol. And if it's an eye for an eye, you really want to avoid a round two.
How do you respond while trying to engage politically, trying to deter militarily?
Does a new round of bombings on our military bases mean we're about to strike back in the Middle East again? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When President Biden came out this week and says it doesn't matter who you are, what you do, as long as you're an American adult, there will be a vaccine dose ready for you by the end of May. For the first time, that created a real sense of before and after. Because if what he is saying holds, before May 31st, people will remain at risk from the most deadly pandemic we've seen in our lifetimes, whether they like it or not. But in the weeks after May 31st, your risk largely becomes a matter of choice. Yes, there are children who can be hospitalized with COVID still, but that's far less likely. And there are adults who are allergic to some vaccine ingredients. But post-May, that world just looks fundamentally different than the one we've been living in. However,
at least 11 states have either recently loosened restrictions or plan to in the coming week. In Texas, the governor ending the statewide mask mandate and reopening businesses at full capacity starting next week.
Texas, I think it's a big mistake. Look,
this also served as a cue for several states to go, okay, no more lockdown rules then. Companies can make you wear a mask, but we're not going to.
And the last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine, take off your mask, forget it. It still matters.
Which raises the stakes around these vaccines even further, right? Because the new question is, who gets to ride out these final few months of high risk in safety, and who has to wait?
When I signed up to teach, I didn't sign up for hazardous duty, folks. I served 8.5 years in the military. I never once feared for my life. I do now. What in the hell are we doing?
Well, that question has been especially tricky for the Biden White House because there are about 4 million teachers in this country, and they can affect whether tens of millions of families are able to even send their children to school. And so in that announcement on Tuesday, there was another key piece of information that a lot of people didn't catch at first, that starting next week, any teacher in any state, regardless of that state's eligibility list, could potentially walk into a pharmacy and say, I want to sign up for my shot right now. ABC senior White House correspondent Mary Bruce is with us. And Mary, I know you've been traveling around with the First Lady as she went by some schools. Can we just clarify the rules, though, as they stand right now? Like, at what point can any teacher in this country get vaccinated?
It's a good question. Right now, what we know is that even if your state hasn't declared teachers eligible yet to be vaccinated, and there are 20 states that haven't done that yet, teachers and childcare staff are now being offered these vaccine appointments at some roughly 9,000 pharmacy locations nationwide.
Throughout March, they will be able to sign up for an appointment at a pharmacy near them. Now, I want to be very clear. Not every educator will be able to get their appointment in the first week, but our goal is to do everything we can to help every educator receive a shot this month, the month of March.
And that's because the president, through this federal pharmacy program that they have, had said, look, you have to put teachers at the front of the line because they feel that getting teachers vaccinated is a key part of this strategy to being able to fulfill the president's promise to open most schools by the end of his first 100 days. So by May.
Which I guess means like there's conceivably someone out there that doesn't get vaccinated as quickly because a teacher just took their spot, which I assume a lot of Americans could handle that, Mary, as long as they're convinced by your answer to this next question. Is the White House actually following the science on this? Should teachers be getting vaccinated, or is the White House just like trying to appease some teachers' unions?
It's a little bit of both. The White House is walking a very fine line here and trying to have it both ways.
When you talk about infection within the school setting, it's what really is going on in the community that is the risk of infection to anyone, including
the CDC
teachers.
Makes it very clear that teacher vaccinations are not a prerequisite. It's not a must that a teacher be vaccinated in order to safely return to in-person instruction in the classroom.
That really is rather impractical to make that a sine qua non of opening the schools.
This morning in Chicago, Boston, and Baltimore, tens of thousands of students now back in the classroom. But the doors are still shut in Los Angeles.
Until staff has been given access to vaccines, and until we have robust health and safety measures at each site, we will not accept an arbitrary return to school day.
But teachers' unions have been demanding that teachers do get these vaccines in order to feel that they can safely and comfortably actually instruct students face-to-face.
What's your message then to other essential workers? Are teachers really more at risk in the classroom than Americans who are working in a meatpacking plant?
Well, look, certainly the president has taken a number of steps over the last couple of days to expedite the availability and the access of vaccines to Americans across the country working in a range of industries. This is a step that he felt was important to take because of the impact on the next generation of kids.
And when pressed on this exact question, the White House has been very quick to point out they insist this is not about politics. This isn't about partisanship. It's just them trying to do everything they can to reopen classrooms, get students back in schools, which of course is key to returning much of the country back to a semblance of normalcy and giving parents some much needed reprieve.
And it seems like such a disconnect in what these groups are often talking about, because the government's saying, like, hey, it's not a prerequisite to have teachers vaccinated because, like, schools aren't creating these big clusters of coronavirus in their communities. Well, the teachers aren't worried about, like, the big clusters of coronavirus in their communities. They're thinking, I can't have 20 or 30 kids running around that might be getting coronavirus from a parent and then giving it to me. I don't want to get sick. I'm at higher risk than a lot of other people. So, like, the CDC guidance doesn't always address their issue. But I know you have just been with the First Lady touring schools. She's a teacher herself. What have you been seeing?
Welcome to the kindergarten!
Thank you. So nice to be here.
It's really interesting that the First Lady is upping her role in this fierce debate. She was out touring two schools in Connecticut and Pennsylvania, ones that the White House feels have successfully reopened.
I love that Ninja Turtles. Does that help you breathe better because it's Ninja Turtles? I bet it does. And you're Spider-Man, I saw that, right?
The First Lady, along with the Education Secretary, essentially out listening to folks to see what works in these communities. The First Lady herself, of course, an English professor who is teaching virtually this semester. She made a point of saying to teachers, look, I get it.
And last week I said to my students, hey guys, how are you doing? And they said, Dr. B, We're doing okay, but we can't wait to be back in the classroom. And, you know, I think that's how we all feel, but we just know that we have to get back safely.
This is obviously not, I would imagine, what you envisioned when you thought of a career in education.
No. We all want the kids back. This is not normal. This is not logical.
I was surprised by how many teachers we talked to here said they want to be, of course, back in the classrooms. This is not normal. This is not the way they want to be teaching.
What's it going to take to get there?
The vaccines for every teacher.
But that they feel that that vaccine is absolutely critical to them feeling comfortable being back teaching.
The CDC says that's not a prerequisite to having teachers back in the classroom.
No, but they would feel more comfortable and they would be more willing to do it. Because they want to teach their kids, but they just aren't sure. And you have to put so many mitigation factors in place, like shields and masks and making sure that kids understand masking.
But Brad, I have to tell you, even in this school district that is being held up as a model of some sorts by the White House, even here where they have been open since August, they're still in a hybrid. Parents here are happy with it too, but they also recognize this is only temporary. They hope. They hope that once teachers get vaccinated, their kids will be back in the classrooms full time.
Yeah, and just to give you a sense of how skittish medical officials still are about getting people's hopes up too soon, we've been told the CDC plans to tell Americans, yes, once you're vaccinated, you can confidently go to a small gathering if everyone else there is vaccinated too. But they are still not saying that publicly. If there's a schedule for saying that, it has been pushed back. Mary Bruce, there in Connecticut, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next Next up on Start Here, they weren't ready for January 6th, so they've been getting extra ready for today. We're back in a bit.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
As chaotic as January 6th felt, the assault on the Capitol did not come out of nowhere.
We're gathered together in the heart of our nation's capital for one very, very basic and simple reason: to save our democracy.
There was the promise of this big speech from President Trump that had already drawn lots of people to Washington. There was lots of hype around the counting of Electoral College votes.
And Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us. And if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country.
But lots of people were also being drawn by this really dark conspiracy theory that this was the day that Congress would and should be rounded up by American service members and volunteers.
Where are you, Nancy? We're looking for you.
Bring him out.
Bring him out, Pence.
Bring him out.
They had been told this, they said, by a government insider named Q. And for weeks, law enforcement had seen this chatter, but despite the fact that this was all based on something totally bogus, that January 6th was the day to be prepared. Well, when it was all over, the conspiracy theorists did not stop believing. Many didn't stop believing when President Biden was sworn in, contrary to everything Q had ever told them. No, these people believed there must be another day in the near future in which the government would finally be flipped upside down. The day they ended up circling was today, March 4th, which is why federal law enforcement is saying there are serious threats to look out for in the nation's capital right now. Let's go to ABC's chief investigative reporter, Josh Margolin. Josh, can you just walk us through today? What is happening in Washington?
Well, Brad, what we see today is a greater law enforcement presence. Everybody's on edge. There's this general concern that has become heightened in the last few days that there could be violence, there could be some amount of acting out on part of the groups that we saw involved in the January 6th insurrection, that they might be returning to Washington to take physical action against Congress.
In an intelligence bulletin overnight stating an unidentified group of militia violent extremists had discussed plans to take control of the U.S. Capitol and remove Democratic lawmakers.
And that threat authorities say they're taking it seriously. I'm wondering, how serious is it, actually? Like, what do we know about this threat?
Well, the threat is actually fairly simple. You know, if you follow the conspiracy theory associated with what was going on January 6th, the idea is that the election was stolen, Donald Trump should be the legitimate president. And so the January 6th insurrection was an effort to get in there to stop Congress from finalizing the steal, quote unquote, the steal being stealing the election and making Joe Biden the president. This new date, March 4th, goes back to the earliest days of the United States. It's the original date, March 4th, of the inauguration of the President of the United States.
On March 4th, 1929, Herbert Hoover left his private mansion to become the 31st President of the United States.
And so the conspiracy theory goes that actually Donald Trump would now return to Washington on March 4th, the original day in the Constitution.
Like January 20th, that was all a sham. Today's the day that is Donald Trump's real re-inauguration.
Exactly. You see, the thing here, remember, Brad, is that the conspiracy theory is bogus.
Right.
So every single date, every single thing that they said that was going to happen hasn't happened.
Right.
So they've had to keep moving the goalpost.
We will win this, and we, as far as I'm concerned, we already have won it. So I just want to thank you.
So first it was going to be Donald Trump's going to win the election. That's November.
We can say that Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. is on track to win the state of Pennsylvania.
That's one thing. So that fails.
The electors of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania have cast 20 votes for the Honorable Joseph R. Biden.
Then they say that the electors are not going to vote for Joe Biden. Well, the electors did what they're supposed to do by law. They voted for Joe Biden.
We will stop the steal.
Then they say, he says that they're going to stop the certification of the electoral votes on January 6th. Then we see January 20th, that wouldn't actually happen. There was actually a theory, the QAnon conspiracy theorists believed, that January 20th, somehow Donald Trump wouldn't take off and go to Florida. He would return to Washington. He would be reinstalled as the president. Biden and Hillary Clinton, they would be, some people thought they would be killed. Some people wanted to say that they were going to be rounded up, whatever it was. None of it actually happened. We're living in a world right now where Joe Biden is president and Donald Trump is in Florida.
But so then, I guess this sounds more complicated to monitor than like your stereotypical terror attack. Because I think in the public consciousness, we assume there are lots of bad guys out there and they're planning something very concrete, and then they either do it or they don't. But in real life, in reality, it's a bunch of people, you know, exchanging messages with each other that says like, hey, wouldn't it be nice to kidnap so-and-so? Or like, hey, we should head over to D.C. and stop the steal. Like, you don't know what that means. FBI Director Christopher Wray called a lot of this chatter aspirational earlier this week.
And separating out which ones are getting traction, which ones reflect intention as opposed to aspiration, is something that we spend an enormous amount of time trying to do. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of time and the ability to make those judgments.
But like we've seen the chatter come true several weeks ago. So does the whole bar of what is worth preparing for, does that change now?
It's very, very hard. That's the hardest part of law enforcement's job. It's trying to figure out what the legit threats are versus just the bogus, quote unquote, aspirational threats and chatter they see. So, you know, January 6th represented a failure because there was all this chatter, all this information and intelligence that was out there, and law enforcement did not properly prepare.
After a frantic call for help from the Capitol Police Chief, it took more than 3 hours for the Defense Department to send in the D.C. National Guard.
At that point, seconds mattered, minutes mattered.
We want Trump!
When the green light was finally given, Walker says they arrived within 18 minutes. But it was too late.
Everybody stay down! Get down!
So we have clearly a bit of an overreaction where law enforcement is not going to get fooled again, so to speak.
I don't think there is a great deal of concern at this point, but they want to be extra careful and make sure they do get those bulletins out because there was a bulletin that didn't make it up the chain of command very far on January 6th.
So that's what they're doing. They are ramping up. Preparations, there's a way to do preparations. You make sure you bring in extra reinforcements. You make sure that there's riot gear on the ready. You put additional forces in the surrounding area on alert.
Tonight, the Capitol complex still surrounded by fencing topped with razor wire, some 5,000 National Guard troops on duty.
Also, it means that if there happens to be a large group of people that winds up starting to descend on Capitol Hill or any of the other landmarks, you can be rest assured that law enforcement is not going to let that just develop and fester and see what happens and maybe hope for the best. That's not what's going to happen.
Yeah, the House of Representatives actually tweaked its schedule so that its members won't even be at the Capitol today, again, because of how real these concerns have become. Josh Margolin, thanks for breaking it down.
Brad, thanks so much.
Well,
Last month, a military base in Iraq was hit by rockets. This was a base mainly run by Americans, and there was no real doubt about what was happening here. This was one of these Iranian-backed militia groups trying to mess with Americans. The U.S. felt it had to respond, and it did.
The U.S. military launched two warplanes into eastern Syria near the Iraqi border on the orders of President Biden.
That whole strike from the U.S. was designed to say to Iran, okay, this is done. You hit us, we hit you, but let's not escalate this, no more. Well, that now appears to be wishful thinking.
I want to get right to that breaking news overnight. At least 10 rockets blasting an Iraqi airbase housing U.S. soldiers.
Yesterday, several bombs rained down on another base, again housing American troops. And ABC's senior foreign correspondent Ian Pannell is right there in Iraq. Ian, I mean, what can you tell us?
Yeah, Brad, this certainly isn't over. Yesterday morning, 7:20 a.m., 10 rockets slam into the Ain al-Assad airbase in western Iraq. It houses U.S. coalition, mainly Iraqi troops at that base. As far as we know, no U.S. troops were hurt or killed in the attack, but we do know that one American contractor apparently died of a heart attack while sheltering from the attack.
We're identifying who's responsible, and we'll make judgments from that point. Okay, thank you.
We don't know at the moment exactly who's responsible. President Biden saying it's being investigated. An Iraqi military commander based at that same airbase in western Iraq has told ABC News that he's convinced it was the same Iranian-backed militias.
If you're the U.S., like, how do you respond? If you're trying not to provoke a hot war with Iran, what are your options? You can't just say, like, oh, bummer, you got us, so we will pack up our troops and go home.
Yeah, welcome to the chewy world of the Middle East, right? I mean, it just isn't that simple.
So the status of that at this point in time remains that the United States is open to having a diplomatic conversation, to sitting at the table and having that discussion with our...
The Biden administration is trying to engage with Iran politically and diplomatically over the nuclear agreements that President Obama signed, that President Trump withdrew from, the so-called JCPOA.
And America should have a lot of fear. America should have a lot of fear.
But not all of Iran sings from the same hymn sheet. There are elements within Iran who doesn't want to sign a deal with America. Mm. There are people on the ground here in Iraq who are backed by Iran who don't want American troops on the ground, who want to drive American troops from the area and extend Iranian influence. And so that is what's going on here. But yes, you're right. How do you respond while trying to engage politically, trying to deter militarily?
If we assess a further response is warranted, we will take action again in a manner and time of our choosing. And we reserve that option. The president
that is a very difficult balancing act, as the new administration is finding. Much easier to be in opposition and to criticize than be in power and have to rule.
Hey, by the way, kind of related, but isn't the Pope, like the Roman Catholic Pope, supposed to arrive tomorrow? Is he about to walk in, what, to a war zone in Iraq?
So there you are in Rome, your Pope Francis's team, and you're already looking at a new outbreak, a fresh wave from the pandemic here in Iraq. You're looking at the threat from ISIS, which still exists in the country, and now you're having rockets being traded across air bases in the country. There are many people who think it's too dangerous for Pope Francis to come here, but he's absolutely adamant. And you have to doff your cap to him in some ways, because he's flying into this troubled area. But for him, this is a much-needed pilgrimage. Pope John Paul II was the first pope to want to try to come to Iraq, but no pope has stepped on this land, which is regarded as sacrosanct by many Christians. It's the land, arguably, that is the birth of Christianity.
How does it feel to be working on the setup for a papal visit to Mosul?
This is a big honor for us.
So this is a high-risk mission, but it's one where he wants to deliver a message to Christians in the region that the Pope is with you.
Father, first of all, thank you very much for giving us some of your very precious time.
But also a message of unity at a time of such sectarian differences.
So when I left Mosul, it was about 400 to 500 families. But when I return back now, there is just 70 families.
After so much war, so much strife, his is a message of love and peace. And I have to tell you, you know, I've spoken to Christians and Muslims alike. Iraqis are desperate for that message, if only their political and military leaders would allow them to get on with it.
Right, right. As always, the circumstances in Iraq, not always even dictated necessarily by Iraqis themselves. Ian Pannell, they're on the ground. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. We've seen lots of art auctions, but we've never seen an art auction for something like this. The famous Nyan cat meme is just that. It's a meme of a flying cat with the body of a Pop-Tart arcing a rainbow through the sky. It's the internet. I don't know how to better explain it than that. But a remastered version of this meme recently went up for auction and sold for more than $500,000. This is becoming a thing.
A clip of a digital flower sold recently for $20,000. A sock sold for $60,000. And specifically a LeBron James clip recently sold for almost $100,000.
That's Mark Stenberg, a media reporter for Adweek. He says, welcome to the world in which GIFs and JPEGs can be bought and sold. They're called NFTs, non-fungible tokens.
An NFT is a record that shows who owns a unique piece of digital content in the same way that a vehicle title shows who owns a particular car.
Because this is all digital, it's enough to make your head hurt. But follow me here, because you're going to be hearing about this more. Let's say in the case of LeBron, you happen to snap the perfect photo of him dunking on someone. It was such a good photo that other people would pay for the right to use it. Well, you're only going to get paid if you can prove that photo belongs to you, as in you have the original negative. That is the thing that is finally changing in internet art. Systems like Bitcoin have made it so you can tell what is a copy and what's an original.
You mint an NFT, and then you basically create a sort of what people call a smart contract that lives on the blockchain.
And you might be asking yourself, why would I ever pay for a GIF of a Nyan cat when I could literally pull this up on YouTube and look at it for free right now? Stenberg says, think of how there are tons of Starry Night posters out there, but there's only one original Starry Night. There are lots of photos of Mickey Mantle, but only one rookie card. And now that you can tell who owns each of these things, you're seeing NFTs sold at mainstream auction houses like Christie's. But that's only part of the reason these prices are going insane.
I think a really big propeller here that's been a little bit overlooked is the Wall Street Bets episode.
These next generation investors have sent the financial world into an absolute frenzy.
I'm not going to give any advice to the Wall Street Reddit crowd. They're making a lot of money.
Which essentially cued in a lot of people to this idea that, hey, there could be some really weird ways to make money on the internet, and I don't want to miss out on the next one.
The start of the rush for NFTs has been linked with the launch of the NBA's Top Shot website.
And this really popular platform called NBA Top Shot, which essentially sells clips of plays that occur in the NBA.
Sensing an opportunity, some celebrities like Post Malone and Grimes are making their own digital pieces of art and selling them to fans.
If you have a musician that you love and they release an album and they mint an NFT, you want to buy that in the same way that you would buy merch from a legendary tour that that band was on, to say that you believe in them, you support them, and you were an early stakeholder in their work.
In fact, on Friday, Kings of Leon will release their new album as an NFT, which will only be available for 2 weeks. You can think of it like a digital version of a vinyl record. 2 weeks from now, they're not making any more of them. You would have to buy this digital item secondhand. So this is also interesting. I think I'm getting my head wrapped around it. And yet the name of these things is still non-fungible tokens? Like, that's the name? I thought you guys were, you're supposed to be good at branding. What are we doing? Hey, if you're liking the show, it really does help us out when you leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Tell your friends about the show, your digital cats about the show. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.